Rabbit Hole, your favorite Bitcoin podcast.
But I don't want to go among mad people.
Oh, you can't help that. Most everyone's mad here.
What's up, everyone? It's your boy Kaz. I'm here to tell you about Swan Bitcoin. Swan Bitcoin is the best way right now to buy Bitcoin. They allow you to dollar cost average into it on a daily, weekly, or monthly basis, and then withdraw to cold storage, self-custody those keys. Don't wait for the perfect time to buy Bitcoin, because the perfect time to buy Bitcoin was yesterday. Start dollar cost averaging with Swan and start sacking some sats. Go to swanbitcoin.com/Kaz. You'll get $10 worth of Bitcoin when you sign up. Hope you enjoy this episode of Down the Rabbit Hole.
All right, what's up, everybody? Welcome to the first episode of Down the Rabbit Hole. We've got my buddy Jack McGeary here. Did I say that right?
You did, yes.
So this is actually Jack and I's first time talking in person outside of, you know, the 45-minute conversation we just had before this podcast. But, yeah, we exchanged a lot of messages online. He's a good buddy of mine now. Talk about the market, macro theory, gold, investing, pretty much everything. Yeah, so I just want to give you guys a little lead in to what we're going to talk about today. So with this is obviously a Bitcoin podcast, but to understand Bitcoin, I think you have to understand what's going on in the rest of the world. And so the first episode today, we're going to talk about macro theory, you know, what's been going on with the central bank, you know, since 2009 with coronavirus, you know, what's been the global response from central banks? And, you know, what's happening really with the dollar and other fiat currencies? And why is that something you should relate to gold and Bitcoin and other scarce assets? So we'll get more into, you know, what is Bitcoin and why specifically Bitcoin down the line in other episodes. But this one's going to be solely focused on, you know, what's going on in the world and why we should lead you down that rabbit hole. So I thought Jack was the perfect guy to come on this first episode, which, hey, I appreciate it, by the way, being my guinea pig.
Yeah, absolutely. I appreciate the invite to the first episode. It's a big invite.
Big time. So you want to go ahead and introduce yourself and sort of give a little background of who you are and why you got interested in all this?
Yeah, absolutely. So my name's Jack, obviously, like I already mentioned. And for a profession, I'm an architect, government contractor for the Army. And then in my side time, I like to think about how I want to locate my money. And it's been a passion of mine from a few classes I took in school, just a range of topics that kind of combined together. And that was finance, economics, mostly macro, and then psychology as well. And kind of combining all those two, or all those three there, you get the stock market, you get the macro markets, the currency markets. And I like to think about game theory and how individuals are going to interact in these markets and where in the long term I want to be putting my money to be protecting myself and my family moving forward. And so that's kind of how I've found myself in this industry here.
Yeah, I think it's super cool that, you know, you don't work for a hedge fund or a bank and you're thinking about all these issues and really studying them as an architect. And I think this is a really important message for anybody who may be listening to this is, you know, you don't have to be a money guy to start thinking about these issues. And it's really going to help you to get ahead once we start explaining some of these topics, which I would just like to give a disclaimer. These are pretty dense. We're going to try to break some of these theories down and these definitions down. So if you have no economic experience at all, you know, you should be able to understand them, at least how they relate to you. Maybe not all the implications, but we're going to try to give you those. So, yeah, so Jack, if you want to just give us a little lead in for what you think has happened since 2009, you know, as a response. So obviously this is not going to be on a what caused 2009, but what was the response of 2009 and how did we get to where we are now?
Yeah, I think most people probably are familiar with what happened in 2009 and for the most part why, but what happened afterwards was bailouts. The Fed started to bail out the big banks, started to lower interest rates, and then eventually leading into the first quantitative easing that we've ever seen. And then the second, the third, and so on. And so, yeah, I mean, that's basically been, in a nutshell, the Fed's response, which on a surface level seemed to have been working fairly well.
Yeah. I mean, it was pretty much anytime the stock market went down, okay, we're gonna print more money. So when we say quantitative easing, which is a fancy term for the Fed printing money and adding to the money supply, which has a direct, you know, knock-on effect of increasing asset prices like the stock market. So yeah, that's exactly what I was thinking too. You know, we had you know, multiple sessions of QE where we printed money. We simultaneously, you know, continually lowered interest rates, and for many years we suppressed them at near zero. We really just didn't start raising them until, you know, I think it was 2017, you know, whenever Trump was getting elected. And then sort of the fiscal response to that, you know, Trump lowered taxes and, you know, gave tax breaks. And then with all of this, you know, cheap money, big companies, you know, bought their own stock back because they could easily take on the debt. So they would basically issue debt and then, you know, buy their stock back, and that would increase the price and make it look like the market's doing really, really well. So then we fast forward, you know, to today, where we have all this cheap money, and Ray Dalio, he's a big macro guy, talks about, you know, we had a huge debt bubble where, you know, every citizen, you know, everywhere in our society, like, there's just massive debt, whether it's a corporation, whether it's the government, whether it's individuals with credit cards or student loans, everywhere. It's just massive debt.
Yep. Pensions,
yeah. And then we have this sort of great accelerator, which was COVID, which basically just brought our economy to a screaming halt and essentially pricked this debt bubble, which we saw. I don't know if you want to comment on that at all before we talk about what was the effect of that, but
yeah. So bubbles and how these things are created, like you touched, it's a lot of buyback, and it's also a lot of just buying debt in general for companies. They're not worried about being cash flow positive. They're just worried about growth. And that's extremely common in bull markets. Companies just continue to leverage down to accelerate their growth, gain market share, but they aren't cash flow positive, which, when you do have a downturn, can create a large debt bubble. It's just, you know, just in that one corporation, but there's many of them doing the exact same thing. And we've seen these in every recession, and I believe they're referred to as zombie companies. And there's tons of them in the market right now. But another thing that we were talking about earlier actually was the inverted yield curve. And yield curves are essentially, to kind of break it down, there's long-term yield curves and short-term yield curves. And they're determined by various different debt instruments that you can purchase and get returns on. And it's been a rare indicator in the past to predict different recessions. And we actually saw the inversion of the yield curve, which is essentially when the long-term yields less than the short-term.
Yeah.
And we saw that for the first time a year ago in March. And typically this is predicted, these kind of popping of debt bubbles and effects on the economy that have resulted in recessions in the past. And we just are starting to see the beginning of this before COVID. And now we have this, right, this ultimate accelerant come in and just really shake things up and add a ton of unpredictability.
So for somebody who may not understand what an inverted yield curve is, if you want to just explain that sort of in a high-level term, essentially it's like where short-term maturities yield more than long-term, which means that there's not long-term faith in the economy, at least from my understanding. That's what it is.
Right.
Yeah, so that's obviously not a good sign, you know, if you're looking forward at a recession. So and then we also had the repo market back in September, I believe, of 2019 blow out, you know, overnight. So the overnight repo market is where banks lend overnight bonds to each other at the rate that the Federal Reserve sets. And it usually stays around, you know, whatever the rate is, which at the time was around, like, what was it, 1.75 or 2% or so?
Yeah, that's about right.
And then overnight, it shot up to, it was like 12 to 15%, I believe, which basically means there was a liquidity crunch, which means everybody was just scrambling for cash, and they couldn't get it. So it drove the yields up on these overnight bonds. You know, they skyrocket. And no one even talks about this. Like, this happened a year before anybody even said coronavirus. And essentially what the response was the Fed printed money to make sure that the banks had enough money in their reserves, which in my mind, that's quantitative easing. Nobody called it QE. So that's like QE 3.5 that no one really even mentions. And so this is also another topic, just real quick, like, banks have to, or they used to before coronavirus, they used to have to hold 10% of their balance sheet overnight, essentially. So, you know, you walk into, this is how the banking system works. This is fractional reserve banking.
Yeah, I think that'll be great.
Yeah. So you walk into a bank, you know, you deposit $10,000. That $10,000 will show up in your account, but in reality, it's not always all there. They take 90% of what you deposit, and they use that as a basis to loan to other people. So really, like, at any given time, you know, the bank could only have 10% of what it shows for every single person that holds money in that bank. So if everyone at the same time tries to just scramble and pull money out of the system, you know, it doesn't exist. Which that actually changed with COVID. So I think this would be great to now talk about. Okay, so that's all the backstory. So now, like, what happened with COVID, right? So we have this great accelerator, this virus that, you know, shuts the economy down, you know, shuts down supply chains, shuts down currency flows all over the world. And, you know, we're losing jobs, like, at a astronomical rate, you know, faster than we've ever lost jobs. And what is the response of the Fed? So now this is where we have QE4. So we have QE 1, 2, and 3 from like 2009 to like 2015. And we printed more in 6 weeks in March than all three of those combined. So we essentially added about $6 trillion to the money supply in 6 weeks.
With plans to add more here in the next couple months as well.
Yeah, exactly.
And what that QE that... That's the stimulus, that's the PPP, that's these big headline Congress bills and initiatives that we've all been seeing in the news.
Yeah. Oh, and this is something we actually didn't talk about before. I just think is incredible. Now they're saying that if you took out more than $2 million in PPP loans, that you don't have to repay it.
Yeah. You won't be audited either. To like see if you actually needed it. The original, for those who don't know, it was originally anything under $2 million, they wouldn't audit you, and it would be turned into a grant as long as you kept your employees employed. That's what the purpose of the payroll protection plan was. And then now they've recently come out and said, I think they put a range on it, maybe 2 to 5 or 2 to 10 million.
I didn't see the range.
Okay, maybe it's just more than 10 million or 2 million. That's crazy. And so now those won't be audited, and it's a grant. You don't have to pay it back.
Infinite cash. So
yeah, printer go burr.
So I think it'd be helpful now to explain what are the knock-on effects of doing this. So how does this relate to, you know, the dollar, and then how does this relate to inflation in the individual?
Yeah. To explain why the Fed does this, it's monetary liquidity. they're trying to put money into the market, and they do it through the banks, and they do it through these loan programs, which are turning into grant programs. And the reason they do that is for liquidity issues, to make sure people can continue to pay their debts, pay off the loans that they have, continue to pay for rent, continue to buy, like, at the rates that we have been. And the banks are kind of used as, like, pipe work, essentially. If you think of, like, a plumbing system, the banks are kind of the vessels to get this money into the market. And when we first saw these things back in March, the big concern was that they were going to get stuck in that pipe work. A lot of the banks weren't willing to do the PPP loans. The banks were changing their loan programs. It was harder to get a home loan. They were changing their requirements for those kind of things. So the Fed has to work extra hard to make sure that these banks can continue to provide the money. And the banks hold this money because they need to, they have their own loans they have to pay off. They have their own debts they've accrued. And so that's kind of the slowing of the money. And so it's not just that the Fed needs to print money. It's that the Fed needs to print money and they need to create vessels to get the money moving again. So I would say that's kind of the first part of why the Fed does quantitative easing here.
Yeah. So they do all this for those reasons. And then how does that relate to the money supply? Obviously, it increases the money supply, which over the long term, you know, causes currencies to inflate and asset, or really asset prices to inflate. And what does inflation mean, really? So inflation is the prices of goods and services or assets increase relative to whatever currency it's denominated in.
Mm-hmm.
So it takes more money to buy something. So essentially purchasing power goes down, and asset prices or good prices of goods go up. So why does that matter to a 25-year-old that may be listening to this podcast? So they say that, you know, targeted inflation, whether you believe that's what it is or not, is around 2% a year. So if you're saving money, you're not putting it into a vessel to increase returns that outpace inflation, you know, around 2%, then let's say over 20 years, you're losing 40% of what you've saved. So that's why, you know, guys like Ray Dalio, like you mentioned, I think you said this before we started the podcast, we were talking about it, and you said, you know, cash is trash, right? So if you're not using these vessels, whether it be the stock market or gold or, you know, Bitcoin, obviously.
Real estate,
whatever it is that outpaced, like, the inflation rate, you know, you're just losing money. And if you're not simultaneously increasing that, you know, you're never going to move forward. You're really going to be moving backwards. So you just continue to work harder to see that you know your savings are depleting.
Right. And even you might even see your savings increase. You might have more money in it in 2 years from now than you do now. But the question is, what can you purchase with that? It's the purchasing power that you mentioned, right? It's the basic supply and demand, where the increase of the dollar, or the supply is increasing in the dollar because we're continuing to create more money. The demand is decreasing because the smart money is moving to assets, because the assets have a finite supply. I mean, for instance, Bitcoin has a very finite supply. Gold has a relatively measurable finite supply. Land has a finite supply. There's only so much land in the U.S. I mean, these assets are the ones that people take their money and put it into because the supply is not changing, but the demand's increasing.
Yeah, and
that's
scarcity.
Scarcity, exactly.
Yeah, so that's like the definition of, you know, why people look at these alternative assets is scarcity. It's just the simplest reason, you know. If we have reckless, which I call it reckless or irresponsible monetary policy from central banks to do this. I don't think they have a choice, given now that we're off the gold standard. You know, we have been since 1971. So, you know, what happened in 1971? If you look at all these graphs, right? It's like, why did everything, pretty much wages, like, are stagnant? you know, every other sector of our economy is just, you know, shooting straight up. And yeah. It's like, what happened in 1971? Well, we got off the gold standard. So it surprises me still to this day how many people believe that we're still on a gold standard. And it just blows my mind, really.
There might be a few people here who don't know what the gold standard is. Would you want to explain that a little bit and how you would coin a,
yeah,
a gold to the dollar?
Right. So a long time ago, you know, let's maybe give like just a brief talk, like introduction into why was a currency ever created, right? So a long time ago, we had people that were self-sufficient and they did everything on their own. And granted, it was very technological process was very slow during that time. And then, you know, societies grew and people started to specialize in what they did. They're like, okay, you know, there are more things for me to own outside of my house now, or not really a house, but, you know, whatever they were living in at the time. And so they're like, I can't physically specialize in all these different trades. So we need a mechanism so I can have, you know, I raise goats, you know, you farm tomatoes, you know, how many tomatoes are you going to give me for a goat? You know, that you can't really negotiate that. So like people started to use all these different instruments to facilitate this trade, you know, and it's been so many different things throughout history, you know, seashells and rhinestones and pearls and
different metals,
different precious metals. I mean, salt, that's where the phrase, you know, he's worth his weight in salt. That's where it came from. And so after we became more civilized, we started using silver and then eventually gold because we realized that these are, you know, very tangible. They're pretty, you know, they're difficult. It takes human effort to create them. And you can't just create them out of thin air. And that makes them, they call that hard money. So, you know, it facilitates trade. It's very difficult to reproduce. And that gives it value because you can't just do like, you can't just print it out of thin air, like sort of like what the Fed is doing with money right now. So what was your original question again before I
got just the dollar being pegged to gold.
Yeah, yeah. So, and then in 1913, we introduced like the central bank, we call it the Fed, the Federal Reserve, and we have money pegged. For a while, you know, we were trading things in actual gold. Then the Fed comes in. I don't remember exactly when this was. They basically take everyone's gold. It may actually made it illegal to hold gold.
So I think it was in the 30s, kind of post-World War II.
Yeah, I think it was too. And they come in. They make it illegal to hold gold. They basically say you have to return all of your gold, and then they're going to issue now this note, and they called it the dollar, and it was redeemable in gold. So it's like, yeah, we had at that time a fixed monetary policy that the dollar was relative to gold. So essentially, you know, you can't really see it, but all the money that sits in the central bank supposedly, you know, comes out equivalent to the dollars that were in circulation. And they weren't ever going to just, you know, print more because, like, that would cause the devaluation of the dollar. And so this is what I think caused us to get rid of that standard completely was because at that time, the governments realized that the only way for them to finance war was to increase taxes. And in the late 60s, you know, people did not want to, they did not agree with the war. And they were like, you know, we're not going to pay war taxes. And governments at that time realized, you know, not just the U.S., you know, the U.S. government, governments all over the world realized, okay, why don't we just get rid of this gold standard? And we will now move to, it's called a fiat currency, which is basically what's giving the weight of the dollar, which is a whole another conversation, but really it's you're believing in the strength of your government, whether that's, you know, they're going to pay their bonds, they're going to pay their debts, you know, the military, all of that gives the dollar strength right now. Ours is also propped up by oil, which is another conversation. But yeah, essentially in 1971, we kicked this gold standard And now we print money whenever we feel like it. And I feel like we've now gotten to the point that this is a drug. And, you know, we take on all this cheap debt like we've been talking about. And the only way to get out of it is to just print more. You know, it's like a junkie.
Yeah. For any of those keeping at home, it was 1934 was when we created that gold standard. So post Great Depression, not post World War II.
Oh yeah.
Yeah. That's spot on with why we kind of stopped pegging, I guess, the dollar to the gold, because for the longest time you could trade in your dollars for gold.
Right.
You could definitely not redeem your dollars for gold anymore.
Okay, so I think that's great. Now let's move into, and Jack's actually the guy who showed me this theory. It's called the dollar milkshake theory. So Jack, if you want to give the audience a definition of what this is, and we can kind of discuss what the implications of this theory mean.
Yeah. So dollar milkshake theory, named after a milkshake. If you think about when you're drinking a milkshake and it's got all the ice cream in there and you're pulling it through a straw and it gets stuck. It gets really hard to pull out. And you have this milkshake and it's full of ice cream, but you're forcing it all through this one straw. And the dollar milkshake theory is what I would call a tail risk. It means it's in the realm of possibility and it's something you should be aware of. And it has that black swan type effect where it's hard to predict what exactly would happen if this came true, but it would likely not be good. And I guess it mostly relates to when this dollar liquidity tightens, which we've talked a lot about quantitative easing, and this is the first start of tightening it. And you could see if the Fed, I mean, our rates are close to zero now, less than one. And what this is predicted, that if we were to increase interest rates anytime soon, if owners of debt were no longer able to get the dollar, and this is foreign countries, companies, anyone who owns debt in the U.S. dollar. And I guess you kind of have to understand what a global reserve currency is.
Yeah, I was going to say the exact same thing.
And essentially post-World War II, there's a great book called The Accidental Superpower. It's written by a guy who actually lives here in Austin as well, Peter Zeehan. And he talks about how the U.S. became the great superpower it is now and why we have the U.S. dollar as a global reserve currency. And he basically ties it down to that every great country, every current superpower in the time of World War II had war fought on their land. And their economies were devastated. And I mean, we had Pearl Harbor in Hawaii, which was homegrown, but it didn't really affect our whole nationwide economy. And so we were the only country to really emerge out of World War II still as a dominant force in the world. And what the US actually did, which was very smart at the time, was created trade deals where we would allow all these countries to export their goods to our country. We would buy their goods, we would import their goods, and we would give them the dollar in exchange. And we had a stable economy, so they were willing to accept that dollar. And over time, people continued to believe in the dollar, and that's how the dollar became the global reserve currency. And everyone felt comfortable trading in the dollar, and the U.S. offered protection in the seas for any country that wanted to ship goods anywhere else, as long as the exchange was done in dollars. And so fast forward to now, we have all these foreign countries that do trade and exchange debt in the U.S. dollar. And there could come a time when they don't have access to the dollars because there's not enough of that velocity in the monetary supply, which would ultimately result in the dollar skyrocketing. I think I was reading yesterday, north of $1 trillion U.S. dollars to make interest payments on the dollar-based debt, and that's what foreign companies and foreign countries hold, north of $1 trillion they have to make on interest debt. and they need access to this dollar. And when you have something like coronavirus, where we don't have this international trade that we had, they're not able to obtain these dollars to pay on their debts, which circles right back to that debt bubble, right?
Right.
But this is more on a global scale.
Right.
So I think that's kind of the introduction there to the dollar milkshake theory.
Yeah. I think what you expanded on with the dollar reserve currency is fascinating. I'd like to read that book. I didn't know that about the land.
Yeah. It's really good.
And so essentially, like, what he's saying is, I think it's around, it's like 79.5%, maybe more now, of global trade transactions are done in the dollar. So that means the dollar is very liquid. Everyone wants to hold dollars. In some markets, you have to trade in dollars. So there's a demand for dollars. And what we're seeing right now, which I was reading about this yesterday, so we had this change in accounting rules after 2009, which I'm not going to go into what happened before, but essentially after this change, it's called repo accounting, where the same asset, you know, a government bond or whatever it may be, is held by multiple parties. So it could be, you know, 5 or 10 different financial institutions hold this one particular bond or asset. But it's recorded as an asset on all of their balance sheets. So no one really knows who owns that. And the maturity is so far out that, you know, we don't really need to see at right this specific moment, you know, who owns it. So some of the macro guys estimate that there's around $100 trillion in this dollar shortage, which is exactly what Jack's talking about with the dollar milkshake, right? So we're seeing that, you know, the whole world demands dollars and they have to transact in it. And now we have this effect with coronavirus where, you know, we print $6 trillion, okay? And so there's an indicator, it's ticker DXY, people call it the Dixie. So the Dixie is the dollar index, which basically measures the strength of the dollar relative to a basket of foreign currencies. I think there's around 6 or so, but it's the major players, the British pound, I believe.
The euro.
The yen. Aussie
yep.
dollar. Caddy dollar, I believe.
Yep, Canadian dollar for sure.
All the major ones. And it's basically, okay, relative to this basket, you know, how much is there in the, like, how much strength is there in the dollar? So we print $6 trillion in 6 weeks, and the Dixie doesn't move. That's wild to me. So with everything that we've explained so far with inflation and increasing the money supply and what that, you know, how that affects currencies, we printed $6 trillion, which is more than QE 1, 2, and 3 put together in 6 weeks, and the Dixie didn't move. And that shows, like, this dollar shortage that we're talking about is, there is a huge liquidity crunch on a global scale for the U.S. dollar.
Right. So that the Dixie not moving indicates that although supply has increased, the relative ratio is still equal, meaning the demand is there.
Yeah. And so as a response to this, now we have the Bank of Japan, the European Central Bank, the Bank of England are now all printing money at the same exact rate that we were in March. And they're saying pretty much they're going to do it for the next 3 months. But the problem with that is these currencies are 50 to 70% less liquid than the dollar. So if the dollar's almost 80% of global trade transactions, then, you know, this money is mainly staying domestically in these countries that they're printing. And so the inflation that we're going to see in those countries is going to skyrocket because there's not a demand for the currencies like there is for the dollar. So.
Right. So then we're going to have an oversupply of the euro, the pound, undersupply of demand, causing an inflation in assets, right?
Absolutely. And then you look at countries like Turkey, like the Turkish lira right now is one of the currencies that's experiencing hyperinflation. And then you look at their stock market. and their stock market, it's like the same exact graph. One, they're both just skyrocketing. It's like, well, why is that? It's because there's a hyperinflation. The money supply is increased at such a rate that, you know, the demand for goods is just skyrocketing. And so people are looking for a safe haven for their money. And in Turkey, you can't invest in, you know, you don't have the same options to invest in everything that you can here. So they look at their domestic market, and it's just exploding. So I think that's kind of, you know, what we're going to start seeing in some of these other countries. And, you know, Jack and I have these, like, sort of digital manifestos where we talk about macro theory and what's going to happen with different currencies relative to the dollar. And I think we're both on the same page now that we're both very, very bullish the dollar in the short term, for at least. Bullish gold and bullish Bitcoin.
Yeah.
And the reason for that is because all of these currencies are now going to relatively destroy, the dollar is going to destroy them. And that's going to just prop up, you know, I could see once, like, we have, you know, this could be, I don't want to put a time frame on when I think this is going to happen, but the euro dollar market, which is different than, you know, like the dollar euro forex market, the euro dollar market is what they call just pretty much anything, any transaction in the world that's used in dollars that's not done in the US. So it's like a global sort of indicator for dollar transactions. And the euro dollar market is starting to show some signs of, like, sort of a collapse. And this is directly like dollar milkshake. So we have all these foreign central banks now that are printing money, destroying their own currencies domestically. And the dollar is just going to suck it all up. So that's the analogy of the milkshake that I don't think we ever completed.
Yeah.
And that's why we're so bullish the dollar, is because, okay, you know, we're seeing it in these smaller, these, like, you know, less powerful global countries like Turkey, Venezuela, you know, they're already experiencing, Argentina, you know, they're already experiencing hyperinflation. You know, I don't know if we'll see hyperinflation on, like, a currency collapse scale in, like, Europe for a couple of years, but I definitely think it's going to happen. And all of that is going to move into dollars, I believe.
Yeah, it would be the safe haven of currencies.
Yeah.
And I agree. I'm long the dollar right now as a tail hedge risk for this event, because there's definitely signs of it. It definitely looks like if it's going to happen in the medium term, it's going to be in the next 2 years.
Yeah.
For sure. I think the central banks and the Fed and all the printing that they're doing, while it's going to have long-term implications on inflation, no doubt, they have to be doing it right now. Now, as soon as they ease on it, that's when things start to get uncertain. I mean, just here in the U.S., I feel like every week I'm reading about more and more massive corporations unable to make rent payments. The Nordstroms, the Macy's, the big retail. You know, and they're unable to make payments, and these are just the beginning signs of those companies not being able to get enough dollars.
Yeah, and so this is something that's a direct effect of coronavirus that we keep referring to as this accelerator, but we see this happen whether you go down at the very micro level, like, you know, like ordering takeout food. Dude, I bet order delivery during the quarantine skyrocketed.
Yeah.
Then you move it up a notch, and it's like, okay, you know, work from home. Which, these things were already happening, but they were happening slowly. Then we have COVID come in, and it's like, this is why it's an accelerator. It's like, okay, now order delivery skyrockets. Work from home skyrockets. Cloud computing, you know, skyrockets.
Yep. But there's still uncertainty in, like, digital advertising.
Yeah.
You know, like, are companies willing to spend that money yet? And that's just
a choice. And then you talk about the Macy's and the brick and mortar stores. I mean, I feel like this is something that's been coming for a long time. And coronavirus is just like the nail in the coffin.
Yeah. It's definitely accelerating this tech move for sure.
Yeah.
I mean, I've been working from home since March.
Yeah. So,
and, yeah, sorry. Go ahead.
I was just going to say, so after knowing all of that, the dollar milkshake theory, you know, we're bullish dollar. Why are we bullish gold and Bitcoin if we think, you know, I don't know if you're there yet. I'm still a believer that we're in the midst of a currency collapse, and it's not going to affect the dollar for a long time, but eventually it will. So if we have, you know, everything we laid out with, you know, sort of developing countries falling first, they now say, okay, I'm going to move to dollars, which means they have to trust the U.S. government, or they move to other assets like gold or Bitcoin, which they both have pros and cons. Bitcoin is not owned by central banks in the way that gold is. So if you move to gold, you're still trusting in the same central banks that were reckless and irresponsible to begin with. Moving to something like Bitcoin, it's decentralized, it's global, it's censorship resistant. So, you know, if I'm sending money to somebody in Venezuela, which I don't know anybody in Venezuela, but if I were going to, you know, that transaction is going to be blocked by our financial system because we have sanctions directly against Venezuela. I don't even know how you would mail them gold. And actually, I read an article like 2 weeks ago that Britain was supposed to ship Venezuela, like, I'm going to butcher, but it was like a couple billion dollars worth of gold, and the U.S. blocked it. They would
same Iran tried to do that as well.
Yeah. So it's like this is a knock-on effect of having the U.S. dollar as the global reserve currency. So it's if these countries have policies in place or they have leaders in place that we don't like, we're just saying, okay, you know, you don't have direct access to the financial system anymore. And that goes for dollars. It goes for gold as well, too, like we can see. So an alternative to that would be a decentralized currency, and that's governed by open source computing power on computers all over the world, like Bitcoin.
Right. And gold has stood the test of time.
It has.
And it has to do with scarcity, the fact that you can validate it. What's a little bit nicer about Bitcoin is it's a lot easier to transport. And I don't think we're there yet with Bitcoin, but it's pretty hard for me to take my gold bar into 7-Eleven or, you know, buy a ticket to a Mavericks basketball game. You know, it's a little bit harder to do that with a brick of gold.
It's funny you mentioned the Mavs. They actually accept Bitcoin payments now.
Do they?
Yeah. Oh, I didn't know that.
No.
Yeah. Mark Cuban's finally. He used to destroy it publicly, and then now the Mavs accept Bitcoin for tickets.
Right on. See. Yeah. A medium of exchange. That's what a currency's, you know, their main goal is.
Yeah. And you mentioned it's valuable because it's easier to transport and transact in, but it's also easier to verify. So I don't know if you've ever tried to verify your gold bars, but it costs about $5,000 to $10,000 for the right machine to do it.
And there's a lot of money in fraudulent gold.
There is, yeah. Gilded copper is a huge thing. So if you're not buying your gold from a reputable dealer, you should probably think twice about that. But Bitcoin, outside of having, you know, a hard cap supply, which I think that's the biggest value case. So we're talking about all these things with inflation and increase in the money supply, the quantitative easing, all this. The bull case for Bitcoin is that it has a hard cap supply. And on top of that, the inflation rate of Bitcoin goes down every 4 years, and you know the exact time pretty much it's going to happen. So it's going to happen at a certain block. That block, you know, happens basically, a block happens around every 10 minutes, give or take. You can say, okay, around within 2 to 3 days in 4 years, the monetary policy for Bitcoin is going to change. And that's something you can't do with central banks. They can change it at a whim, and there's really, you know, there's not a lot of rhyme and reason to why it's changing or how much it is, and, you know, sort of who sees the benefits of it. You know, this is an Austrian economics term. You talk about the Cantillon effect. I don't know if you've heard of this.
I haven't.
This is basically where when you have QE, where does that money get injected into society? So, like, outside of the payments that went to the to U.S. citizens, which in relative terms to the amount of money they created was not a lot. It was
not
like,
much.
It was like, shut up, take your $1,200 and be happy. But the money that they gave to corporations and businesses was way higher. But that started, you know, essentially at the top. And then it trickles down, you know.
So yeah, like, trickle down economy.
Yeah, you know, big businesses got tons of money. They, like, you're buying Apple debt. I mean, what's Apple going to do? Right? So, I mean, their stocks are just now tanking or, skyrocketing.
Yeah.
And by the time that money trickles down to the rest of the economy, we're going to see the effects of inflation that we're talking about. Higher asset prices, higher prices of goods and services. And that's one of the reasons I think that, you know, the market's moving the way it is. And so, yeah, they call this the cotillion effect. It's like QE is essentially like universal basic income for rich people.
Yeah.
You look at like the net worth.
Those who hold the assets.
Yeah. You look at the net worth of people like Elon Musk. I mean, since pre-COVID, so we're not talking about like the bottom of the market. We're talking about pre-COVID, like February timeframe. His net worth has increased like almost 60%.
Yeah.
He passed Warren Buffett this week.
Hey, shout out. He passed Warren Buffett. Yeah.
That's wild.
It is. It's like the passing of the baton.
It is. Which I'm a huge Elon fan, so I like it.
Yeah, I'm a fan of any entrepreneur.
Exactly. I mean, I know Buffett employs a lot of people. They both employ a lot of people, so you can't directly make the argument that Warren's making money by other people. But I mean, Elon's way more direct. I mean, he's actually starting businesses. He's doing the hands-on engineering for a lot of the businesses he starts. That's a lot different than, like, investing in companies,
I think. Yeah. And you got to support the, you know, he's making the wave for the new age. Very impressive. Space, electric cars.
Absolutely.
I want to jump back for a second, though, like, with the dollar milkshake theory. Yeah. So that's one outcome. That's in that. That kind of protects you against if the dollar increases, and which you can be long Bitcoin or gold, and they would both be beneficial there. But what happens if we don't see this kind of black swan event, and everything the Fed does is enough? What do you think is the impact from that? I mean, I would imagine we would see a couple years of insane inflation in asset prices with all the money being printed.
It would have to be.
The dollar would just drop.
Yeah. It would have to be. I mean, then you see things like, I mean, I think the dollar milkshake theory, I hope that's what happens, because if it's not what's happening and it's the latter, like you mentioned, then it's going to be a very scary outcome, because I think there's a lot of national security in our stock market. And definitely with the strength of our dollar. So if those things come into question, you know, I don't know if I like the outcome, because then you have places like China that they're very, very close to completing their central bank digital currency, which is we essentially use digital currencies all the time, but this is one, it's a token, a blockchain based token, which, you know, I don't want to see some of the other superpowers gain strength. I'm not the biggest U.S. government bull, but I'm definitely not a fan of the other ones. So
right. Yeah, I think, that's when it gets scary, is once that inflation train leaves the station, it's headed for hyperinflation quick.
Yeah.
And it would be tough to slow down. The goal here is to maintain a manageable rate of inflation. Anything beyond that starts to look like those other currencies that we've seen hyperinflate and destruct on themselves, which is not good. But even in that case, you can be long gold and long Bitcoin. I think the U.S. dollar internationally is best when it's weak. it allows for the most trade and import, specifically imports to the U.S. And the U.S. itself is strongest when the dollar is strongest. So it's a bit of a balance between there. And again, I'm going to reference back to the accidental superpower, where Peter explains what happened in the last 50 years, and then he gives his prediction for the next 50 years. And he talks about actually a lot of what we've seen with Trump in office and the trade deals that he's made with only specific countries. And Peter kind of says that we're starting to look like we're going to head to actually a deglobalization, where we actually rely on ourselves a lot more for the creation of products, stop, you know, importing semiconductors from the Asian markets when we can make them at home. And he talks about how our greatest allies will continue to be Canada and Mexico, the access to manufacturing, the access to oil. We have the financial markets, we have the tech sector, we have the Midwest for agriculture, we have the coastal ports. We're really one of the very few countries in the world with access to all of that. And if we move that way, it would be because the dollar likely becomes too strong for international trade.
Yeah, I mean, I think that's been a direct response of Trump's policies. I mean, he's very nationalist. He's very deglobalization.
Right.
And he's also very kind of torn between strong dollar but negative interest rates. So I think that's a very interesting stance. He wants negative interest rates, but he also wants a strong dollar. But at the same time, he does want to weaken the dollar. So I think that there's a fine line.
Yeah. He kind of seems to change depending on what's going on in the world.
Yeah. And I think that's... I mean, I think there's a problem with all politics and bankers at the central bank level, is just the incentives in that part of society don't align to the incentives usually of the average person. So there's a huge disconnect there.
Yeah.
And
there's a lot less skin in the game.
Yeah. And Trump's going to do
for those constituents.
Trump's got to think about a lot of other things, which I don't want to get into politics about it. But, I mean, he's got a lot of things to think about, and those could be, you know, what's more beneficial to him? Does he get reelected if we have a strong dollar or a weak dollar? And so that's what kind of where his alignment is, and he may not be thinking, you know, on the global level at every moment in time. Which I think at the end of the day, I think he does want, you know, America to be strong globally, and he wants deglobalization. But
yeah, I feel like what's tough for us is that the Fed and the White House are constructing this monetary policy in closed doors with 12 people in the room. And I they have less skin in the game than I do. They own these assets. The decisions they make are likely to benefit them a little bit, but I'm not even going to have an insight to what the decisions are. Yeah. And I think that's just one of the things that you were talking about with Bitcoin, that it's a very transparent monetary policy. And it can't be one person who changes that.
Yeah. And you have direct skin in the game. I mean, if you actually own Bitcoin and you hold it securely, you run a node, you know, you're essentially a bank.
Yeah.
You're your own bank, and you have direct say, really, if you're running a node, like what are the changes that you're going to accept in the network, which I think is pretty revolutionary. Obviously, I'm a huge
Guy. Does it take like over 50% agreement for something like that to change?
It depends on like what the issue is.
Okay.
Nodes can decide if they want, like, say there's a big network change. They can decide which one they want to run. So it's really like, you know, a decentralized consensus.
Okay.
And you could have nodes that run on both. Eventually, like, they'll all gravitate towards one. But if not, you know, they'll fork off and make another chain and call it a different Bitcoin, but it's not Bitcoin. That's like when you see Bitcoin Cash and Bitcoin SV and all those other, you know, sort of bullshit coins that aren't Bitcoin.
Yeah. That's what I don't think people understand. Is they're like, well, why doesn't, you know, the U.S. just make their own coin? Or what happens when China makes their own coin? Or what about all these other coins out there? It's, I think you'll probably get into it in the next two episodes, and I'm excited to hear that, because I think you definitely understand the nuances a little bit more than I do. But, I mean, Bitcoin is a one and done. Like, there's only one shot at a decentralized currency with transparent monetary policy that has continuous open quantitative tightening that you're aware about at all times. I mean, with a finite supply, there's only one shot at that.
Yeah, there's one shot.
I mean, no one can just come and create a coin now. Like, with network effects, like, you couldn't follow the same path and get to where Bitcoin is now with the network effect. And all things considered, you can't recreate it.
Yeah, no way. And that's what I try to tell a lot of people that are new. They come into Bitcoin and they see all these other coins you can buy, and they get like, oh, well, you know, this one's better. This one's faster. This one, you know,
right.
Bitcoin has a pretty low supply, but, you know, the fees are lower. And they're like, oh, this one doesn't use energy. You know, this one's, you know, staking. It's like, okay, those are meant to distract you. Those coins are bullshit. Do not buy those.
The Dogecoin.
Yeah, the Dogecoin. Oh my gosh. So this is something that we haven't talked about at all. It's like the growth of the Davy Day Trader, Robinhood Trader guys
that
are driving this market. I mean, I think the Dogecoin pump is one, you know, it's
the TikTok Dogecoin pump. Yeah, I mean, this is full force 2020.
And that, to me, that's showing a bubble. You know, when people are getting financial advice for a meme coin, it's literally named after a meme. There's no development being done on it. It's less than a cent. And, you know, people are buying it because they saw a TikTok video that went viral. And you can buy it on Robinhood, which is just like the epitome of I know nothing about the market.
Sort
of guys that are getting their financial advice from Wall Street Bets and Davy Day Trader. So,
yeah, the zero commission and Robinhood has definitely helped accelerate the adoption of the market.
Oh yeah,
and I don't think it's scary. All bad though.
I think it leads to a lot of weak hands.
Definitely.
So these people, like, they're, you know, they come in right now. I'm sure you're making a lot of money, but I mean, do you see that drop? And, you know, so one of the things I think is leading us out of this hope phase, which I think is what we were, into more of a insolvency phase, is pension funds. So pension funds essentially follow earnings projections, and they've now lowered, like, the earnings projections. So they're saying that a lot of pension funds are going to, like, unload equities. So they're at, like, 65% equities right now.
Yeah.
By the end of the year, they're going to get down to like 45%. So if that happens, I mean, I think we see a big, you know, leg down in the market again.
Yeah.
And we've had since March, you know, all these, like, people come in trading off Robinhood, don't have a lot of experience in the market. You know, buying meme stocks and all that. So, like, if we have a huge leg down, you know, they could just be like, okay, I'm out, you know, I'll cash out. So then it's like a compounding effect of the market, you know, tanking.
Yeah. I mean, there's so much cash on the sidelines right now as well, like waiting to be put into equities. But a lot of people believe that when VIX, which for anyone who's not sure what VIX is, it's basically a volatility measure of the market. And for years it hovered around kind of the 15 number. And, you know, back in March when everyone was selling everything, it topped off around 80. So now it trades in like the 30 to 40 range. But a lot of people, specifically money, people who want a slow rate of growth, will not invest in a market where VIX is over 30. And honestly, I think a lot of VIX staying at that 30 level has to do with what are called the Robinhooders, which, whether they use Robinhood or not, it's just a class of investor. And it's just these people who buy these ridiculous stocks, and then everyone piles in, and then they all jump out. and they have these weak hands. And so I believe that is playing a factor into kind of keeping this volatility high.
Yeah, I mean, you have a big class of young investors that are buying bankrupt stocks.
Yeah.
There's no fundamentals in that.
But, you know. Right on. Yeah. I didn't know that about the pensions. It's that's really interesting. Do you think that plays into this earnings here in the next couple weeks?
I don't think it plays into this one. I think it plays into the next one.
Okay. Yeah, I mean, I was watching some indicators this week as far as the Treasury bonds. They were hitting some pretty close to new lows,
yeah,
which is
close.
Definitely something to keep an eye on. And
do you look at the 5 or the 10 the most?
I mostly am watching the 30 right now.
Really?
Yeah. I watch the 10 and the 5 a little bit, but I've been watching a lot of the 30. Yeah. I mean, we definitely saw some move to bonds this week. So, yeah, I mean, it'll be interesting with the earnings coming up. And kind of to elaborate on what we were discussing a bit before the podcast started was this market does seem crazy. And I hear the bubble, you know, the term word bubble being thrown around a lot, and whether it's a stock bubble, I mean, sorry, a tech bubble or a full market bubble, I'm not sure. I almost, you know, wish I had the experience to have traded and invested in, you know, the 2000 Y2K tech bubble, because it would be a great sentiment indicator for now, because I just can't be sure that it's a bubble or not. It definitely feels like everyone and their cab driver is telling you what stocks to buy. Buy Hertz, buy Dogecoin, you know, buy it all. Buy the dip, right? I mean, we've been so trained for years now, just buy the dip, right?
Yeah, buy the dip.
Dude, keeps working, though.
Girls from high school messaging me on Instagram asking me what stocks to buy.
Yeah, just so tell them Dogecoin.
I think that's a big indicator for me.
It is. It is. But the other thing we talked about, right, is like when the supply of money increases, you have to put your money in assets.
Yeah.
You can't keep it in cash. And so where do you put it? I mean, these $1,200 stimulus checks, I hope one day we get a stat on how many of those went directly into the market.
I saw one for Coinbase, which is like the big cryptocurrency
exchange. Yeah.
They had like a skyrocket. They had this chart for like, I don't know how they did it, but they basically looked at the number of people that made purchase increments of $1,200.
Yeah.
And have like this line, you know, whatever. And then it's just like straight up. So a lot of people put their, hopefully in Bitcoin, not in all these other random currencies.
Yeah. But you have to put it somewhere. Yeah. And
it's better than buying a TV.
Yeah. So that's it's exactly going to have a better return for sure.
That's what they want you to do, is go, you know, spend it on something pointless to stimulate the economy.
Yeah.
So if you're doing anything like buying gold, buying Bitcoin, you know, putting it in solid equities, you know,
yeah,
you're probably doing the right thing.
Pay off any debt.
Yeah,
that's a good one too.
Always
especially debt becomes a big problem when the dollar gets strong.
Yeah. Real estate, anything.
Yeah.
So you've kind of led to it a little bit, but I want to hear like why you bought Bitcoin specifically. Because I think you bought it before you met me, so I didn't convince you to buy Bitcoin.
So. Right. You did convince me to buy a little bit more. Okay. I'll say that.
So what made you a Bitcoin? Outside of sort of the properties of it that you mentioned before.
Yeah. I mean, the very first time I heard about Bitcoin was in college. So I graduated A&M in 2018. So it was probably freshman year, 2014. People were talking about Bitcoin. A couple people just asked me about it, and I didn't really understand the technicals of it, but I was aware of it. And but funny enough, like what people were using it for back then was to like buy fake IDs off Reddit, like just things like that. And I mean, that guy ended up making an extra couple $1,000 later in, I guess, 2017. So I was familiar with it, but I hadn't done the proper research. So I started looking around a little bit, trying to learn more about it, its purpose, and actually stumbled upon another podcast. Are you familiar with Anthony Pompliano?
I am.
Yes. Yeah, big Pomp fan. So he had another gentleman on their show, and they did a letter to Ray Dalio, and it was earlier this year. It's really good. Ray Dalio has three critiques on Bitcoin, and they basically break down each critique and explain why Bitcoin is the perfect purchase for Ray Dalio. And I was just kind of digesting some of that, and that's really what probably got my feet in the water with it. And then, yeah, you definitely had me buy some more Bitcoin after just talking about it and understanding these more macro concepts and kind of what's that look like in the current environment. But as far as reasons why, the number one for me was that monetary policy. I mean, I have no idea what's being said and with what intent current monetary policy is being written, especially whenever it's interest rates being changed, when it's where money's going. I mean, I don't really ever get to see that until hindsight.
Yeah.
And sometimes that can be too late. And Bitcoin is very transparent in that. It's all written in code. It's math and factual. And it can't just be swayed by one person's opinion. It's a great scarcity resource. I mean, we all know exactly how many are going to be created, when they're going to be created. And then when you get into a little bit more of the technical side, which I still don't fully understand, with things like the hash rate, they've created systems that will continue to work. I mean, not to dive into it too much, but the hash rate is the network power, right?
Yeah.
And the network power is also in relation to how coins get mined and created. And like, if more miners join, then the equations that have to be solved becomes harder.
Yeah. They call that a difficulty adjustment.
And as more people,
every 2 weeks, which I think this is one of the nuances that a lot of people don't fully understand. They come in and they hear the halving and they understand that. But actually, the difficulty adjustments, I think, in relation to the halving, are what make the Bitcoin consensus model like so beautiful. Because it's like, right, okay, you can't just come in and, you know, spend hundreds of million dollars on machines and then just eat them all up. Like, and, you know, mine Bitcoins way quicker than anybody. It's because as soon as that hash power, which is, you know, the computing power that joins the network, the difficulty is going to go up. So it's just going to get harder to mine. And same thing, if you lose hash power because
and in
of
reverse,
halving,
yep,
then, you know, it's going to get easier to mine. So you make a little bit more, you make a little less, but it stays relative to keeping blocks around that 10-minute mark. It's beautiful.
Exactly. And there's so many smart people building businesses and functions on the network itself, which is quite inspiring.
Yeah.
People who I believe understand these technicals a lot more than I do.
Oh, yeah. Some of the smartest people I feel like I've ever heard on podcasts and on Twitter are all working on Bitcoin. That's one of the reasons I'm so bullish on it.
Right. And then the quantitative tightening, I mean, reverse of everything that's going on with all fiat currencies. And then, you know, a bit of the serendipity of its creation being after 2009 housing market crash.
Yeah.
And why it was created.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely. I mean, I think it's going to be really interesting. So if the dollar milkshake theory does come to fruition and we basically are left, not just we, I mean, the whole world is left with a choice between trusting the U.S. government's dollar, gold, or Bitcoin. What if, and when you look at it, a lot of the countries that are experiencing hyperinflation right now are the quickest to adopt Bitcoin. So what if we get in a scenario where we're, you know, Americans are sort of left out to dry because they trust the government and the dollar so much, and a lot of the world moves to Bitcoin before them. You know, I think that's going to be an interesting game theory perspective.
Yeah. Yeah, there's different takes on it too, as whether it can become a global reserve decentralized currency. But at the very least, it can play that inflation safe haven.
Yeah.
At the very least.
It may not be. So it gets really hazy thinking about the way governments will, you know, if they try to ban it, and there's, I could do a whole episode on the game theory of what happens whenever, like if the U.S. came out and banned Bitcoin and how other nation states would react to that and what the ultimate effect would be on Bitcoin, which I think it's good for Bitcoin. I think it's bad for whatever, the people of whatever country get banned from it.
Yeah.
But, are you there? I think I lost it for a
second. Okay, I think I'm back. Okay. You're talking about the game theory of if a country were to ban. Yeah, I think it was just the quantitative tightening, and then the fact that some people think it could become a global reserve.
Yeah, yeah. Okay, so what I was going to say.
But at the least, it plays the role of a precious metal.
Exactly. Right. So it can be your personal reserve. Pretty much where I was going with that. So whatever governments decide to do with it is irrelevant. It can still be like your personal
reserve, I believe. So.
Yeah.
Okay, I mean, we're 1 hour 10 minutes. We talked about 45 minutes before this started, so.
Yeah.
I guess the last question I have for you is, do you have any predictions for what's going to happen? Not price on Bitcoin, just really anything from a broad sense of what you see happening in the future. Just for fun.
Ooh. I'm just still trying to get through 2020. I can't think too much further out than that. We got an election year that's just setting up for some very interesting headlines.
5 years into 2020.
Yeah, right. Exactly. 5 years in. To be honest, I think the stock market's going to keep running for a while. I really do. And I don't think it has anything to do with, like, a lot of people want to say it's not going to go down in a Trump presidency, but if we keep doing the stimulus, people are going to have to put their money somewhere. And there's so much cash on the sidelines that as soon as we can stabilize just a little bit with a vaccine or anything else, VIX goes under 30, and these low-risk hedge funds can put their money in the market. I mean, it really is setting up for a generational transfer of wealth for anyone who's willing to take the risk now on any of these assets.
Mm-hmm. Couldn't agree more. Man, Jack, that was awesome. Great first rip on the pod. I'm excited that you were the first one to, come on and be my guinea pig.
Yeah, thanks for having me, man. My first podcast, so I enjoyed it a lot. Awesome. Got a good setup here.
You said you're in Austin, right?
Yeah.
You ever come up to the Dallas area?
Sometimes. I wanted to come for St. Paddy's Day this year, but COVID. Yeah. So maybe next year.
If you're ever up here or I'm ever down in Austin, I would love to record another session with you. Maybe.
Absolutely.
Maybe in a couple months, some of this will come more to light and we can see how our theories play out.
Absolutely. I'm excited for that.
Awesome. Appreciate it, man.
Yeah, of course. I look forward to hearing the rest of these podcasts as well, man.